Hi, my name is Kirk Kinder, and this is Saving Yourself from Wall Street, the podcast for people who want to avoid Wall Street's sales tactics, high cost, and conflicted advice so they can take control of their financial life. So let's get to it. Today's guest is Dan David. Dan and I go way back, all the way back to high school in the late 1980s outside of good old Flint, Michigan. Dan was known around school as a no BS kind of guy, and that clearly hasn't changed, as you'll hear in this interview. Dan is the vice president and co-founder of Geo Investing, a firm that is widely regarded as leaders in both the China due diligence and in the U.S. microcap space. In fact, Dan and Geo Investing did such an amazing job of exposing the fraud on U.S. investors with Chinese companies that a movie was made about it. It's called The China Hustle. So the movie was backed by Mark Cuban and produced by Oscar winner Alex Gibney, who produced the movie Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. So this was kind of a big deal. Dan has also spoken at several congressional hearings on the topic of investment fraud, but he found that the culture of D.C. is so anti-common sense and anti-investor that Dan got motivated enough to run for Congress. He ran in the 4th Congressional District in Pennsylvania. So this will be an interesting podcast with a man who went from Flint, Michigan to exposing corruption on Wall Street to the insides of a congressional campaign. All right, Dan, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Thank you, Kirk. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, so you and I haven't talked probably since, 1986 or 87, I guess, right?
It's been 30-some years, Kirk.
Oh, yeah, man.
You are an old man.
but you still look so young. You look like you could be back playing paddleball with my dad in high school. What's going on with that?
Well, I think I could beat him now, maybe.
Well, he's only 75 now. You might be able to get him, possibly.
Well, I'm not sure if he mentioned this, but I did beat him in a round of golf this last summer.
No, he would never tell me.
That wasn't something he told anybody.
Yeah, he would never tell me that. Yeah, in fact, I think he'd even deny it if I approach him with it. But
I have three witnesses.
Well, I was always thankful that you were in his class because I carried about 10 extra pounds thanks to you. Because you remember every time my dad beat somebody in class, you had to buy a dozen donuts. So thank you for all the donuts over the years.
You never stop trying, though.
Yeah. Well, hey, you've got a really interesting story, and just wanted to kind of get that out there. So, we went to high school in Flint, Michigan, and then you end up being a hedge fund manager and a congressional candidate. I'm interested just to see the pathway. How did you go from Flint, Michigan to a money manager, hedge fund manager?
Well, there are so many different ways you could tell that story. Essentially, where we're from, and it's a wonderful place. I love the people in Burton, where our high school was, and Flint, where we're both born. I still have a soft spot for it. But the reality was, in the early 90s, my father saw that this was just getting worse. Globalization came to Flint, Michigan before it was a popular word in the ethos like it is today.
Yeah.
General Motors, made every single car at one time in Flint, Michigan. Buick City was literally 40,000 employees that just made Buicks. And in the early 80s, they decided, we're just going to make a few cars in Canada. And we're just going to make a few cars in Mexico. And then we're just, so them moving out of Flint was taking a lot of jobs, taking a lot of opportunity. And my father saw an opportunity for me to go to the West Coast. And he bought me a plane ticket. And he said, you have to leave and you can never come home to live. And that's
wow.
It was tough. It really was tough. It stuck with me. It still sticks with me today. But he said, you have to have that mindset because you'll want to come home. You'll want to come back. You want to be with your family. You have to have that mindset that you're going to go where the opportunity is and make the best of it. So wow. I did. Yeah. And I ended up working for eventually a jewelry company where I was a regional manager and I had 10 stores. At one point or another, just getting promoted throughout the 14-year career I had there, it took me from San Francisco to Philadelphia to New York. I was in Manhattan for 7 years. The last 6 years, I actually commuted from the Philadelphia area. What can I tell you? I fell in love with a Lansdale Catholic girl. And the truth is, I didn't have to go to the office every single day because I flew around the country. I had 88 Lord & Taylor stores that I was in charge of as a director of stores. And I saw in the mid-2000s what was happening with retail and the internet and things of this nature and with consolidations. And there was this senior executive package that was put together because there was a consolidation on the horizon. All the senior executives saw this coming. And as a part of retention, they basically said, look, you know, we'll give you a year's pay. Give us a year to sort this out. If we don't have a job within 60 miles of where you are, you'll get a year's pay of severance. And in 2006, the job and the place I was at in St. Louis became a very big region. It was 280 stores or something of this sort. And a vice president came down and bumped me out. And they said, okay, well, we're going to promote you to Milwaukee. And you'll have 150 stores and, you know, you just have to move to Milwaukee. And I said, you know, that's not within 60 miles of where I am. So I took the severance. It really shocked them. They were very upset about the whole situation. But the reality is I had an opportunity to work with who is my now partner, Maj Swedan. I met him in 2001 playing flag football. And he was a money manager. And he only traded his own money. He left Vanguard in the early 90s with $30,000 investing in small and microcap stocks. And he was a millionaire before he was 28.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge difference. You go from the, you know, passive Vanguard to managing his own money. So that's kind of a change in philosophy there.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. I mean, he's very, very driven in his diligence practices, which you have to be for a small and micro cap stock picker, because you know it's that area can be rife with fraud and pump and dumps and things of this nature. So he really worked hard at it, and he would tell stories about when he was just working part-time at one point at Vanguard, and he would be in the conference room interviewing CEOs and CFOs for these companies that he was personally investing in. And the Vanguard executives would come in to use the conference room. And he, you know, the kind of guy he is, he would just, you know, in his early 20s, he just put up his hand and his finger said, I'll be done in a second. You guys can come in. And he really wasn't kidding, but they didn't take too kindly to that.
Yeah, imagine.
And his last day, he parked his beat up jalopy Nissan Sentra in Jack Bogle's parking spot.
Oh man!
Oh. And he said before he got up to his desk or his pod or whatever, security was already there.
Oh man!
And, threatening to call a tow truck, but that's Maj.
Wow.
So for 3 years, our first 3 years of playing football together, he barely knew what I did. I barely knew what he did. It was just about football. But eventually some people said, hey, this guy is an operator, runs a lot of stores. And people said to me, hey, you know, this guy made money investing in the stock market. And I didn't really believe it. But it was true.
Wow.
When I got the promotion to go to St. Louis, he asked me not to go and to come to work with him in 2004, and I said no. And he gave me one of the best pieces of advice that I had at the time, and he said, don't sell your home. Rent it out. It's a good investment in real estate. and you can always come back to it. So in 2006, when I took the buyout, he was right. I came back to the home that I had, and I still own it to this day as one of my investments.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, in those years, you know, you're talking pretty much the boom of the real estate cycle. So you probably did see some good appreciation as well.
Yeah. Oh, it's, you know, even today and after the reset in 2008, it's still worth twice what I paid for it. You know, it's 20 years later, but it's good to be diversified. So I mean, I don't want to get off the subject, but even though I do run money and notionally I'm an investor in the stock market, I do keep a kind of a one-third mentality, and one-third in the market, one-third in venture capital, and one-third in real estate.
Okay.
So in 2006, I started working with him, and I was going to run the venture capital part of the business, and he would run the investing. And that went well for a couple of years. I think his hedge fund, I didn't have one, and I wasn't that savvy in investing at the time. It was up, his first year for starting his fund was 2006. It was up 51%. 2007, it was up 49% on top of that.
Wow.
And then 2008 came along, and it was really choppy, you know. And by September of 2008, the fund was flat, which, you know, whatever, in a choppy year, that's not horrible.
Yeah.
But by November, 2 months later, it was down 74%.
Whew. Wow.
Yeah. And a lot of my money was in it. So it was a real eye opener for me, and my partner Maj was just, you know, he was crushed over the whole thing, and it wasn't that he was going to be poor. He still had other investments and was going to be well off, still a millionaire, but he was very upset that he lost other people's money,
mm-hmm.
At least on paper. So we kind of just huddled for 2 weeks at my house. And, you know, a lot of people who had funds at that time closed their fund and started a new fund,
mm-hmm.
so that they could begin to collect fees again. Because, you
sure.
know, in a hedge fund, you can't collect fees until you get your high water mark back.
Yeah, yeah.
And we decided right away we weren't going to do that. And we were going to get everybody their money back, get our money back. And we would continue to use the model he had used for 20 years, which is value investing. And no shorting at all, just value investing. And looking at the value investing and the parameters that we would look at for value investing, what's EPS growth, what's revenue growth, what's margin growth, expansion, barriers to entry for a good company that maybe corners the market, something of this sort, new technology, disruptive. It was all coming out of China. In 2009, you had this RTO wave. And when I say China, a lot of people think, well, you know, you're investing in China's stock market, which you actually cannot do.
Yes.
So these are China-based companies that are listed on our U.S. exchanges. So we believe, like everybody else, because they're listed on the NYSE or the NASDAQ, and, you know, you have Sarbanes-Oxley rules, and you have the SEC enforcement, and you have, you know, top four auditors, Pricewaterhouse, Deloitte, whoever else, KPMG, that they were not unlike any other company in our country. And we invested long in China in 2009. I think 80% of what we had left was invested in all of these China-based companies, and picked up 229%.
Jeez. Now, did you guys have a lot of redemptions after that 2008 year, or did most people kind of agree with the value investing and we're going to stick with you?
Well, the answer to the question is no. We didn't have a lot of redemptions, but I think it was for a different reason. We had two or three, but we didn't have a lot of redemptions because people were like, holy shit, I mean, I have nothing left anyway.
Okay.
I mean, I've got 26% of what I invested, or less in some cases. You know, some people got in after the first year, so they didn't see that big uptick.
Yeah.
And it just, the whole nation was shell-shocked, Kirk. I mean, nobody nobody knew where to move their money. There was no safe haven to go into. And it's not like you could take what little money you had left and go out and buy real estate, because that was falling apart. It was, everybody was just frozen in place. And we had that opportunity while they were doing that. And then we started seeing, you know, gains kind of right away in the spring of 2009. I remember one company, which ended up 3 years later, us finding out was a total fraud. They were on the bulletin board, and their TMI was the ticker symbol. We bought their warrants at 19 cents, and we converted them between $5 and $8.
Wow.
Yeah, it was a huge win for us. And that company eventually became CCME, ticker symbol, and China Media Express was the name of the company. And one of the first exposés done on these China frauds, I think that one was done by Carson Block along with one or two others, was a massive fraud.
Hmm.
So where we went from 2009, we're just on top of the world, right? We, you know, we're picked up 229%. Maj has his mojo back. I had decided during that time that I was going to get much more involved in investing, and I was never going to let, you know, that much of my money be in one person's hands without having a say so.
Mm-hmm.
So I started teaching myself and learning from Maj his value investing method. But, and around the end of 2010, we started to hear these rumblings from people that a lot of these China-based companies that we were invested in were frauds. And many of them we had exited because they hit a price target. So, you know, you're in at five, you're out at 19. Or I remember one we bought at eight, we sold at 28. And we went and looked at these companies and we said, look, you know, either we were lucky or we were good. And if we were lucky, we're going to lose all our money again. We got to figure it out.
Okay.
So we hired our own team to go to China and look at 30 companies and tell us and prove that the short sellers were wrong, that they were just trying to spook the market and make money and whatever they're calling it, short and distort and whatever, the cabal, all that bullshit that they like to throw around these days. And our team came back and said the short sellers are wrong. They're understating the problem. All 30 companies you had us look at are frauds.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So immediately we didn't want to be short sellers. We didn't even really know how to do it. We went to the regulators. We went to the banks that sold us these deals. And we said to the banks, you know, you're taking 5 to 10% of each transaction here. And you're, you know, basically telling people, not basically, actually telling people that you're vetting these companies. And you have teams in China looking at these companies, and they're taking your word for it, and you're getting paid. You're wrong. I'm sure you don't want to misrepresent, so why don't you hire us to do your due diligence? You'll have a better product. And, you know, they essentially said to us, hold on a sec here. You're telling us to pay you to come back and tell us that these companies are fraudulent, which means we can't collect fees, and we're paying you from what?
Yeah.
Why? Why don't you get the hell out of here, go back to Skipack, Pennsylvania before we sue you? So, yeah, we're left with that kind of naivete. And then the SEC and the exchanges were like, who the hell are you? You know, you know what you're talking about. And the SEC cannot put people on the ground in China. I mean, they'd be spies. So their jurisdiction pretty much ends at the Atlantic Ocean. The most they can do is request information, and then that's just through lawyers, and that's another misunderstanding we had. The auditors, they're really no better than H&R Block, right? I mean, you just give them all your paperwork, and they check it.
Yeah.
And they take it at face value, and they put all these disclaimers and qualifiers in their opinion that, you know, basically say as much and try to get themselves off the hook. But the average investor thinks, wow, Deloitte's, you know, auditing this company, they must be fine. Well, you know, Deloitte's just looking at the paperwork they're given, which is all fake.
So basically you talk to the SEC, you talk to the big investment banks, they want nothing to do with it. So at that point, you kind of figure, well, if nobody's going to take action to stop this and protect investors, then we might as well make some money on the short side.
Not even then. This is how dumb we are. Number one, generally, they weren't the biggest banks. I mean, if it was a really big deal, you would get a, you know, B of A or Morgan Stanley, or somebody would come in and be a co-underwriter. But most of these were second-tier banks that were doing these deals.
Okay.
So we still said we didn't want to be short sellers. So we had this website. We're entrepreneurs, right? And we said, we'll do this research. We'll prove that these companies are frauds. And we'll publish this research and not short the stock. That way the investors can trust us because, you know, we're not short sellers. We're just providing the truth. So, you know, the first two companies we looked at were a China Redstone, a cemetery company that had raised money to buy a cemetery, an additional cemetery to what they said they had already owned. We went over there. They didn't own the cemetery. We bought five grave plots. They didn't own the cemetery. We called the cemetery bureau because in a communist country, there's a bureau for everything. So we recorded the people at the cemetery bureau saying they didn't own the cemetery. And with Lotus Pharmaceuticals, they said they had bought a piece of land from the local government for $30 million U.S. And the entire revenue for the local government that year was $21 million. So that didn't add up. And we had the land appraised, and then appraised for like $7 million or $9 million, something like this. So it didn't add up. We, you know, and we went back and forth with the companies. We actually involved the companies and told the companies what we had found. The cemetery company just kept on saying, you know, yeah, they own it, whatever. They have paperwork and a chop on the paperwork. They own it. Lotus Pharmaceuticals tried to tell us, well, it's not just the land that we purchased, but it's the improvement to the land. We're like $21 million in improvement. That's a lot of stormwater retention.
Yeah.
So we published these reports, and the investment community at large said, essentially, if you have a negative opinion, you're a short seller. That's all there is to it. We don't care if you said you took a short position or you didn't. You're a short seller. We're attacked on message boards. You remember when Yahoo message boards were a big deal?
Yeah.
I mean, it was they were brutal. They were absolutely brutal. Towards the end, it got fun to read. But in the beginning, it's just like, what the hell? I mean, don't these people realize I have parents? They're saying this stuff on Yahoo message boards. and so we lost $50,000 in due diligence. We spent $50,000 proving these companies are fraud. We made nothing. So the next company we did, Puda Coal, we shorted, which was an experiment in and of itself. I mean, I remember buying, I believe it was 150 puts, and not realizing that I was actually 15,000 shares short of a $12 stock. And, you know, that was probably 30-40% of my net worth. I thought this better work.
Yeah.
And people have to realize, you know, what we know now is that we can do what we do and we publish our research. Largely you have to, you know, you certainly have to be accurate and it has to be true. But back in 2012, this was uncharted territory. Nobody knew how the SEC was going to react. Nobody knew how the government was going to react. Nobody knew if they were going to call us publishing our research after we had a short position insider trading, right? Because we knew the information. But, you know, largely it's public information. It's not largely, it's all public information in China. Now, if you're in Germany, they have a rule that says that is insider trading because the average German citizen can't fly to China. But, you know, here we don't. But it was a really scary thing to do in the beginning.
Hmm.
And then there are the death threats, which are fun.
Jeez, even death threats then.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. Still. Yeah.
Really?
They're just, you know. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So anytime you talked against somebody who, you know, was making money from these stocks, you know, they don't want to hear anything that would disrupt their profits. So they got to that level where they actually like threaten you online mostly, or were you getting stuff at home?
Well, interestingly, a lot of it was online, and you'd have it on the Yahoo message boards, and you'd complain or whatever. They'd have it taken off. I did have one person meet me in my driveway,
really?
Which was going to escalate quickly. But what you would think would be the companies that we went after would be the ones that are making the threats. But you have to think about it this way. It's not illegal in China to steal from a U.S. citizen. So once they're caught, they've broken the laws in China. They have no chance of going to jail. There's no clawback provision between the United States and China. So the $50 million or $100 million that they stole, they get to keep. So why escalate the situation by hurting somebody?
No,
it wasn't them. It was U.S. investors who had an E-Trade account and probably lost $2,000 that were just out of their mind. I mean, I'm not kidding. I mean, you find out some of these people, you know, how much money they lost. It was a few thousand dollars. It was a lot of money to them. And they would just absolutely go berserk. I mean, who are we to tell them that they were wrong in their investment decision and that this company is a fraud? It's what I found, unfortunately, about our country, especially investing in general, is that people would rather make money on a fraud than lose money on the truth.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I probably agree with that. Anything you do to disrupt them making money, they're gonna get angry.
Yeah, they don't mind if you catch a fraud and you crash the company as long as they're not invested in it.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And so it goes. And so at that point, you know, the auditors, the SEC, and the exchanges started to take us much more seriously. Once we made millions, you know, people knew who we were, and we would take these meetings. I met with the SEC 4 or 5 times, made presentations to them about some of the bigger frauds that we exposed, which is always an interesting experience. And people say to me, that must have been a great meeting, right? You know, you go meet the SEC and you provide this time-lapse video of this company committing fraud, and you've done all their work for them, and, you know, it's a great case. That must be a great day. And I say, no, that's a good day. A great day is when we've done all that and we made a mistake ourselves and they get 2 cases for one.
Mm-hmm.
Because everybody's a suspect when you're talking to them. They're all about cases. So when you go in there, you better have your shit together, because they'll ring you up too.
So did they, I mean, were they putting pressure on you? I mean, were they really getting after you a little bit?
Well, I mean, look, you can't blame them to think that, you know, anybody they talk to in the investment community, it's a one-sided conversation, right? They ask you questions, you answer them. They don't really answer your questions. So everybody's a suspect. And yeah, I mean, there's that economic factor that, like, we make money. Just like somebody makes money on buying a stock and saying, hey, here's the research that I did that made me feel as though this company is going to double in value in the next year. That seems to be fine. Even if they're wrong, they're just optimistic. But when you do that same research in opposite and you say, hey, this is why this company is going to be worth nothing or is a fraud, there must be an ulterior motive is kind of the thought process. So everything's looked upon with skepticism. You build a bit of a reputation and you get less of that. But to begin with, certainly in the early days, there was a, you know, some of the people at the commission were appreciative. Some were actually angry because they couldn't do the kind of work we did. You know, they're just, you know, lawyers and accountants, and they're stuck in their desk. They can't go out and do that kind of field work. They can't do undercover work. And then there are others that are, you know, hey, this is a stepping stone to get to a bigger law firm. If I can, you know, jam one of these short sellers up and make a name for myself, I'll get a bigger job.
Mm. Wow. Well, let me ask you. So why didn't you just start from the very beginning once you started CETUS and just did, you know, some short selling? I mean, I know a lot of people try to demonize short selling, but it makes markets. It provides liquidity. It's a very legitimate way to invest. And if you weren't out putting information out there at the same time and you just kept it to yourself, why didn't you kind of go that direction?
Well, look, I mean, in hindsight, that certainly is something that one would think. But, you know, first of all, we weren't short sellers. It wasn't part of our investment philosophy. So it was kind of a learned thing. And short selling is very, very difficult, as you know.
Sure.
It is not the same as investing. Everybody thinks it's just the opposite of investing because maybe mechanically you're selling instead of buying when you're actually executing the order. But your maximum loss when you're buying a stock is what you put into it. Your maximum loss when you're shorting is infinite.
Sure.
And dealing with some of these companies, once they're called out as a fraud, they can say anything in a press release, right? They're trying to get out. They're trying to create the liquidity to get out as well. Remember, they're not going to be criminally prosecutable, so they might as well continue to take advantage of investors and put out a press release saying they just signed a contract with Nestle. And
yeah.
Boom, the short squeeze happens. Your shares get called in by the bank. You're 50% more than you shorted at, and you know, you're just stuck. And then you can't reshort because there's no short available. There's only so much in the pool of short that's available. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very difficult thing. You can't just say, hey, I'm a short seller now.
Yeah.
You have to learn it. And where I came to after a year or two of doing this, understanding that shorting is a zero-sum game. I mean, investing is everybody wins. Shorting is a zero-sum game. Somebody wins, somebody loses. I started to ask myself, who's losing here? I'm winning, who's losing? And when you really look deeper into who's losing, it isn't the people committing fraud. They're not prosecutable. We can't claw back the money. Where did the money come from? It came from U.S. investors who have no recourse. So now I have to sit with the fact that I'm making money from my friends, my family, my neighbors, from my old high school teachers, pension funds that are all invested in this, and it just did not sit well with me.
Okay.
And that's why I went to Congress.
Okay.
I thought if I couldn't, the SEC didn't have the ability to redline a country. They didn't really have an ability. And we were so intertwined with China at this point. They couldn't just cut off the spigot. It was a congressional action needed to happen. So I lobbied Congress for 3 years, spent over $100,000 of my own money talking to people who are supposed to work for me, which pissed me off. And found that they had little to no knowledge about global economics. I mean, they were just blown away. First of all, they didn't even know that you're not criminally prosecutable if you're living in China and you're not illegal in China to steal from American citizens. That was mind-blowing to them. And they my first year down there, they kept on asking me, what do you think we should do? And I'm like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. I am a citizen coming to my congressman. That's what I think I should do. This is your job. And then my second year going down there, I figured I had to have some solutions. So I offered some solutions from the nuclear option of delisting all of them to a buyer beware option, because at the end of the day, the markets are a buyer beware environment. And I said, look, if you buy a pack of cigarettes, it does say on the package, if you smoke these, they could kill you. There's a warning label. Why could we not, on the ticker symbol of these stocks, or you know, stocks from Pakistan, there are not very many, or other countries like that where people aren't criminally prosecutable, there's an asterisk symbol that you could drop down into a box that explains, hey, you know, nobody here is going to be held accountable. And the money that is sent out of the country to these countries, we can't get it back. I couldn't even get that done.
Hmm.
And then the idea for the movie came. So, you know, all of these things, we're throughout all of this, Kirk, we're all always told, you know, we can't do this. It can't be done. We're going to sue you. I've been sued so many times. I've got one going on right now. I get I get a cease and desist letter every week from somebody. it's like fan mail.
What's been sort of the blowback from the movie, The China Hustle? So the movie comes out. Did that have any impact, positive or negative? Or
I wish it would have been more positive in that, like, people saw it more. It was a widely seen documentary, which is to say most people didn't see it because it's a documentary. And then some people who did see it didn't quite understand it, because you do have to have some kind of finance understanding, mm-hmm. I suppose. There's been some negatives for sure. I mean, you know, China, it's not even allowed to play in China, of course.
Yeah.
Me referring to, you know, senior sitting senator in my party, in my state, as a motherfucker didn't help me when I was running for Congress. Although in my defense, I would have never said that on camera.
Yeah.
If I knew I was running for Congress, but I don't take it back. I mean, you know, the frustration after 3 years, and, you know, Senator Toomey has a banking background, and he was a banker in Hong Kong. So, well, you know, 90% of Congress doesn't know what's going on. He did and does. And he's not helping. So, you know, live with it.
Yeah.
So, you know, and it's been, I don't know, in my community, it's, you know, there's a bit of jealousy that goes around with it, which is ridiculous, because I didn't even want to be in the movie. I thought Carson Block would have made a much better lead protagonist. But for whatever reason, because it was my idea and John Carnes' idea and my partner's idea, Ma Sui Dan, it ended up being one of us that was going to be the lead protagonist. I didn't particularly enjoy the experience at all, but I'm glad it got done, because at least something is out there to inform people.
Oh yeah, that's good. Yeah, I think if anybody watches it, even if you don't have a large understanding of finance, I mean, it's pretty clear that, you know, they were coming in and taking over listings and then just line their tails off. So,
and they still are, by the way. Yeah. Nothing.
Oh,
changed.
They still are.
Oh, absolutely. Now they're IPOs. So, I mean, you know, the Jobs Act under Obama.
Uh-huh.
So it lowers the regulation for these. They're called Reg A pluses. Companies under $100 million or whatever that want to list on our exchange kind of have the same listing standards of the old RTO, but that's a pejorative, you know, name now. So now they're Reg A plus, and it's an IPO, and they're still coming. There's one exposed last week. There'll be, you know, a couple more coming out in the next few weeks. I'm working on a couple right now as my coming back party. Several billion dollar fraud. And you know, the other thing I know is that nobody's going to go to jail over it in China. And the beat goes on.
Yeah. Wow.
And getting back to the movie as well, I would say, yeah, like, you know, there's 100 hours or more of filming. And they boil it down to 82 minutes. And one of the biggest regrets that I see in there, my biggest gripe, is that they essentially cut my partner out of the movie, which was completely unfair in my mind, because he was very much so a part of this. And much more skeptical than I was in the beginning, because me coming from the corporate world, I thought, yeah, these short sellers are wrong, and these companies can't do this. And he was the one that was pushing forward the idea that, you know, no, I mean, this could be happening. We need to look into it. We need to hire that team to go to China. And that was more Ma Sui Dan than it was me. And for whatever reason, I became the face of it. And it's not been great.
Well, it sounded like, so I listened to that interview you told me about, quote the Raven. It sounded like he didn't want to let him into the home, and, you know, a lot of the inside stuff that the movie makers want to do to make it real personal. Whereas you were driving around Flint, Michigan, showing them kind of what a hellhole the city's become. And, you know, that makes for better viewing.
Look, man, that was a huge fight. That was a huge argument And this is how that went down. You know, one, we were kind of self-producing this movie for the first year and a half. Sarah Gibson came aboard, who was wonderful. And, you know, you have a football team of producers, right? There's only one or two that do the work. And she was the one that did the work. And basically, the way we were producing it, we were just doing interviews with a lot of different people talking about what was going on. And I eventually went and met with Frank Marshall from Kennedy Marshall. You know, they own Amblin Entertainment, and he does the Bourne Identities and Indiana Jones and stuff like that. His wife, Kathleen Kennedy, does Star Wars. So they're a pretty big team out in Santa Monica, and sold him on the idea. And he hooked me up with Alex Gibney, who is very well known in the documentary world. Does, you know, he did N. Ron Smart's Guys in the Room, The Armstrong Lie, and so on and so on and so on. Scientology won last year. And once they were on board, I actually ended up hiring the director, Jed Rothstein, and good guy, very good guy. Interesting, he's a hyper-liberal, which I obviously am not. I'm a fiscally conservative, socially moderate. But, you know, we care for each other a great deal. But at that point, when all these people were in place, then Mark Cuban came in and bought the rights.
Okay.
And basically just gave us back the money we put into it. We made nothing off of it, nothing. So Jed then was directing and writing the movie. And, of course, it starts with a lot of the stuff we did. And had they taken the time to get Carson comfortable, see, I was comfortable after, like, 2 years with a lot of these people. Had they take time to get comfortable with him, he would have been fine with it. And as a matter of fact, he works with them today on other projects. So it was just a matter of they didn't really want him to be the lead. I think they liked the fact that I was not a finance guy coming into it. And I was just a regular guy. And they played that up a bit. So their offer to Carson was placating me, saying that this should be your guy, and they really didn't go after him hard like they should have.
Okay.
And as far as Flint goes, I refused to go back to Flint for over a year. I said, I know exactly what you guys are going to do, and I'm not having it. I'm not going to have you go to Flint and film bombed out Beirut and do to this town what everybody else the camera does in this town. I'm going to go, you know, I actually threatened to knock some people out there. I was like, I will knock you out if you do that. And they were hounding me for it. And I just said no. And then we got in an argument over me seeing some of what was happening, and they were not filming my partner as much. It's, why have you not sat down and done, you know, your in studio with Mosh? And they were like, well, we only really need one of you to do this and that kind of a thing. And I said, no, look, that's not fair. That's not right. So the deal was this. So they would do the interview with Maj, which they did 4 hours in a chair. And I would go back to Flint, and they weren't going to film any bombed out houses. So they filmed Maj, cut him out of the movie, went back to Flint, and filmed the bombed out houses.
Oh.
So, you know, I was really pissed about that.
Man. Okay. Yeah, well, I mean, it makes you feel any better, though. I mean, it kind of built your case for, you know, trying to help out the common person, you know, to show that, hey, there's struggles in this world and what's going on, what the SEC and the big banks turning their back to it isn't really helping these folks out who are already kind of down on their luck.
Yeah, I just didn't want it to be fun.
Yeah.
You know, I was, you know, we were both there when Roger and Me came out, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Was Michael Moore hailed as a hero in Flint for making that movie?
Oh, of course not.
No, they hated him for it. And I remember even, you know, having that conversation with my father at the time. I was like, you know, I went and watched this thing, and what he said is true. He's like, well, you know, he can't say that about our town. He's not from here. We're like, he is from here. He's from Davison. He went to Flint Central. or Davidson. He's like, well, he's not from here anymore. And that always really stuck in my mind. I was like, okay, I'm going to be this guy that goes back and shits all over his hometown. And I didn't want that to be the case. And, you know, Jed and I had some long talks over it afterward. And he's just not apologizing for it, nor should he, because that's his creative process. That's his movie he envisioned. And, you know, well, there was this tacit agreement that that was not going to be the movie. He says that it's part of the background and he's sticking with it. You know, I don't make movies for a living. He does. So what am I going to do?
Yeah. They're good. Yeah. That's, you know, Hollywood eyes all the movies. Everything's always, you know, they're looking for their story to tell. So I guess that's part of the process.
Yeah. And, you know, at his heart, he's a very good man. I mean, he cares about what he's doing. He does morally justified movies. Sarah is a wonderful person and very morally sound and cared about what they were doing. And if you look at other projects that they do, it is about helping the greater good. So, you know, while I might have some stylistic disagreements that, you know, hurt, I don't blame them to this day.
Yeah, well, so Dan, you know, we got through that. Like, what are you guys focused on now? I mean, you still kind of just chugging along on the financial side? Because I know, obviously, running for Congress probably was a full-time job, or you're close to it. So, you know, what are you kind of focused on today?
Well, today I'm back. You know, I'm back to what I'm doing. A lot of people are, you know, trying to talk to me about being full-time into politics and doing something else and running again and things of this nature. And I mean, look, it was a soul-sucking experience to begin with. Apparently, there's no such thing as a fiscally conservative, socially moderate Republican anymore. You know, you're either Donald Trump or you're not. And it was painful because, you know, people would ask. I mean, the only people that hated me more than Democrats were some Republicans. How I got out of the primary, I have no idea. You know, they would ask me, do you support the president? And I'd be like, look, I'm running for Congress. That's not the job I'm applying for. The job I'm applying for is to support the people. I'll support a president and their policy one issue at a time. I don't cede that vote ahead of time. That's the problem we have with Congress today. And that goes for any president. It's not about like or don't like. It's about doing your job. And it just – nobody wanted to hear it. It was really a mandate on his presidency, at least in my district, with 70% voter turnout.
Okay.
That's like twice any other midterm.
Yeah.
I had 122,000 votes that I got would have won every other midterm election in the last 20 years.
Jeez.
And I got killed.
Man.
So it is what it is. And I'm just coming back to doing what I did before, and it is being a short activist, which I consider a freedom of speech activist, really. It is about freedom of speech. And I'll fight, you know, any infringement on the freedom of speech like I would the Second Amendment or anything else. If you don't like a law, change it. If you can't change it, then follow it.
Yeah.
So I do these reports in Hong Kong, too. I mean, it tweaks the Chinese quite a bit, but Hong Kong's still a semi-autonomous region. It is that one country, two systems, although it's kind of one country, one and a half systems these days. And it's a bit dicey to do that. And I'm starting a new research firm. And I'll be doing some short reports on my own now.
Okay. All right. Well, so you're focused on that. I was just going to try to get your opinion on what kind of what you sort of see overall, like the economy and markets. I mean, do you think the Fed starting to pull a little liquidity is going to, you know, is it going to show that there's probably a lot of companies that, you know, the old Buffett quote, when the tide goes out, you can see you swimming naked. Do you think that's going to happen a little bit, or what's your view right now?
Well, let's see. In the last 10 years, starting with the beginning of the Obama administration, we had $4 trillion in corporate debt. That's not even, we're not even talking about our national debt, which is $20 trillion and unsustainable. The reason we don't raise interest rates is because we're already paying 7% of our GDP just for debt service. We raised our interest rates, you know, we're talking 10 or 12%, and you know, we're $1 trillion in a hole every year right now based on the taxes we bring in versus what we spend. Raising interest rates would just add to that. We totally screwed that thing up. And by the way, we want free healthcare, free college, and free everything else,
yeah,
which is just not sustainable. I want that too. I really
sure
do, but I mean, it's not sustainable. We're not sustainable where we are currently.
Yeah.
So, and
throw on top of that the, you know, unfunded liabilities for Medicare and Social Security.
And pensions.
You think
the pensions are actually talking about their actual liabilities or the holes that they have in their funds? They're not reporting correctly. No fucking way. No way. It's a huge problem. And yeah, the tide going out is going to expose a lot of people. And I'll tell you who's going to get hurt. The average American worker. And I'll tell you who's going to benefit. The bankers. So going back to the $9 trillion that we have in corporate debt now, we added $5 trillion in the last 10 years of corporate debt. And the question becomes, why did we do that? And what did we do with that money? So if you take that $5 trillion and you say, all of these big companies, household names, took this money and expanded their operations and made acquisitions that were accretive and things of this nature, okay, show me where it actually came back to the bottom line. That's not what happened. The executives of these companies took low interest loans in a low interest environment and bought back stock. And by buying back the stock, they raised the price of their stock. And once they raised the price of their stock, they cashed in their options for hundreds of millions of dollars and billions of dollars. And now they're gone. And when the crunch comes and the interest rates go up and they have to refinance this debt, where are they going to get the money? They're going to have to reissue shares at a lower price, screwing America.
Yeah.
And it's because we have no corporate governance anymore. Independent board of directors for any company, almost any company, big or small, is absolute bullshit.
Yeah.
Most
of the people who go on the boards are usually some political connection, and they're coming on to get their nice benefits, their nice little pay, get some stock options. You know, they're short-termers anyway, with very little understanding of corporate governance.
Right, and they're not being held accountable.
Yeah.
And you know, I could say good things about President Obama. I can say good things about President Trump. And I can say, and that's why I say I call balls and strikes, right? You know, you can't just say either one of them were all good or all bad, although polarizing sides will do that. And one of the things that, you know, you can appreciate that that Obama helped bring us out of that global recession. But I mean, really, where were we going to go? Is the S&P going down to 200? I mean,
yeah,
we didn't have really anywhere to go but up. He did what anybody would do in quantitative easing, but it lasted too long. It's lasted too long.
Yeah.
And now Trump can't get out of it. He's not biting the bullet either and saying quantitative easing went on too long. We really need to raise interest rates so we don't get into, you know, stagflation, right? Japan.
Yeah. I mean, he was saying it when he was campaigning, but now that he sees the effect when the market, you know, when they raise rates, the market goes down, he's changing his tune.
He's tied himself to the markets too much. He really has. He's, you know, he understands that, you know, if the markets really fall apart, which they will, and there's nothing he can do about it. He can delay it for as long as, you know, maybe a year or two tops. But a lot of this corporate debt refinancing comes in 2020 and 2021. Not good for him. But we also, what I disagreed with was making banks too big to fail even bigger.
Yeah.
So now these banks are bigger than countries. And if collectively, they're bigger than our country. So what are you going to do? I mean, how does an investment bank like Wells Fargo or whatever, how do they commit fraud? How is that even possible? It's impossible. yet they pay $1 billion fine for fraud, and they pay $250 million fine for fraud. Banks cannot commit fraud. People at banks commit fraud.
Yeah.
But we don't put those people in jail. And the devil's bargain with the government and, you know, in Division of Enforcement, the SEC, is, look, you want $250 million for fraud, we'll give it to you. But if you want to put somebody in jail, we'll spend $500 million to stop you. And they don't have that in the budget to fight them.
Mm. Yeah. Wow. Yeah, it's really scary. I mean, back, you look back at the Depression times, and there are a lot of bankers that went to prison. Yeah, it was a statutory law. Now you're hoping the SEC might be able to go after them, but like you said, if they don't have the pockets to do it, they can't. They'll take the small fine and go, and then the banks just put that into their calculation for their profit margin.
They do. It's baked into the P&L. I mean, come on. They bake fines for whatever, fraud, FCP violations, into their P&L. I mean, they're just baked into the bottom line. They're going to pay them. Nobody's going to go to jail. And they make more profit in one quarter, less than one quarter, any one of these banks, than the SEC Division of Enforcement has in their budget for an entire year.
Wow, that's just crazy.
So we're at the point now, what can you do?
Man, yeah. So where do you see yourself going here, next couple of years?
Well, I'm going to make a lot of money, and most people are going to lose a lot of money. And, I don't know what to tell you. I mean... Yeah, I know who's going to refinance and issue shares just by reading K's and Q's and company filings and things of this nature and you know where their business is going. I mean, you know, you look at it, it's what I do for a living. A lot of these companies are going to reset at much lower prices in the next year or two. And you know, for most people who are invested in a 401k or a mutual fund, they're not well managed at all. They're being ripped off in fees. It's stupid. If they, you know, an index fund pays infinitely better because you're not dealing with the fees that you have to pay a mutual fund manager who really isn't even really looking at managing your funds. It's just a game. And then these big hedge funds are even worse. You tell me, how is a $10 or $20 billion hedge fund any different than a mutual fund? What's their edge?
Yeah.
There's no edge there.
No.
And they're charging, you know, what, 1.5%, 2% plus 10, 15, and 20% of profit?
Yeah.
I mean, and some of these ultra wealthy are just like, oh, well, I'm an Ackman's fund, or I'm an Einhorn's fund, or I'm a so-and-so's fund, or whatever. It's great. Good for you. You're paying these huge fees for something very little edge, in my mind anyway, relative to a mutual fund. I mean, really, if you're going to have a hedge fund, I think the sweet spot is under $1 billion because you do have an edge. You can go after those smaller cap frauds, which mm-hmm. is a bigger pool of frauds. And even past that, a $50 million hedge fund is great because, I mean, $1 million or $2 million win is impactful.
Yeah.
Going after some of those companies and making $1 million or $2 million matters. If you can just limit your LPs and, you know, maybe have 10 at $5 million or whatever, people are going to make a lot more return for their investment than being in a $20 or $30 billion hedge fund. Ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree. I think. You know, the passing of Jack Bogle here recently, but you know, he's right. Most people are just better off capturing what the markets do and make sure that you find a portfolio that can match your risk tolerance, so you're not going to freak out when things go bad.
If you're spread across index funds, which you know at cheap in fees, and you're over the long term, you're probably fine.
Yeah.
And if you compare that against spread across, you know, just a mutual fund mix, you're absolutely going to do better just because of the fees, the difference in fees, because that compounded money that you're losing from paying those fees year in and year out. So it's just math, Kirk.
Yeah, absolutely. And we all know you were a master of that at Atherton High, right?
Math was my thing. I had, I majored in football, but I didn't mind math.
Well, great. Well, Dan, this has been excellent. I can't thank you enough. If people wanted to get a hold of you or kind of find out what research you're putting out, how can they get a hold of you?
Well, I'm still at Geo Investing, so they can get a hold of me for Geo Investing. I think our platform there is going to be my partner Maj is mostly going to be in the small and micro cap space on the long side, and that's just directly opposed to short selling. So that's why I'm doing a kind of new research firm. I'm not announcing the name of that yet.
Okay.
Only because by the time if I announce the name, then everybody's going to run out and try and grab trademarks and web domains and things of this nature that I haven't quite got that all done yet. And in the next month or so, I'll have that announced. I'll do a media blitz with, Bloomberg, CNBC, and whatever. And I'll be issuing short reports. And I'm strictly going to stick to shorting. That's it. U.S., okay. China, nothing on the long side.
Okay.
And they can follow me on Twitter at FG Alpha Management. That's my hedge fund.
Okay. Perfect. All right. Well, thanks again, Dan. And like I said, if you've got an unbelievably interesting story, and I hope that China Hustle still gets a little bit of traction, because it's what you guys put out there really, I think, is helping. It's really getting the word out and educating folks.
Well, I'm sure there's going to be a China Hustle part two. Hopefully, I won't be in it. But the way it looks now, there will be. And people are going to get more and more aware. And I appreciate your time, Kirk, and give your parents my best.
Will do.
Look forward to seeing them when I'm in Michigan next year.
Okay, Dan. Take care.
All righty. Bye-bye.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. I appreciate you stopping in. As always, you can find our podcast, along with other articles and videos, at savingyourselffromwallstreet.com. And now, the lawyers say hi.
Saving Yourself from Wall Street is hosted by Kirk Kinder. Kirk Kinder is the owner of Picket Fence Financial, a fee-only financial planning firm. Picket Fence Financial is regulated by the states of Maryland and Florida in accordance and in compliance with securities laws and regulations. Picket Fence Financial does not render or offer to render personalized financial or tax advice through the Saving Yourself from Wall Street podcast. The information provided is for informational purposes only and does not constitute financial, tax, investment, or legal advice.